Hello, and welcome back to our podcast, Fanfic the Fanfic, that is itself a synthesis of Fallout, the popular game about a post-apocalyptic wasteland, and My Little Pony, a popular show about pastel horses. Still gonna get that apocalyptic word fucked up every time. Hi, I'm Weird, I'm joined again with my co-host, I'm Fi, I just said Weird.
Oh, I thought we were trading. Oh, how delightful. Okay, yes. Well, okay, this time you can be Fi, and I shall be Sir Weirdington Esquire.
Oh, man. Just gotta roll with the embarrassment. Hi. Welcome back, folks.
I don't apologize. That's the secret to stage work, is that, like, it would have been perfectly fine if he had dropped it there. And now I'm commenting on it.
But it's getting
acceleratingly worse at every
second. The counterpoint is the emphasis on the hyper-real, right? We're creating a sense of authenticity with this cast by announcing our failures. That's the new way of doing it.
That's not how you become president.
You're right, it's not how you become president. But it is how you become a semi-successful YouTuber. So, hi, welcome back again. We're at the end of book one. It's finally time for Aang to defeat the Fire Nation and save the Water Nation by turning into a giant fish monster. This episode is going to be an interesting challenge because it's going to be one half summary of this chapter and then kind of a breakdown of some of the themes and problems we've expressed in short throughout the course of the chapter so far, but like kind of just talking about them in bigger terms is the best word I could think of right there at that moment. But for now, Weird, tell us what we learned.
Oh God, what did we learn? I'm trying to. Okay, so mostly it's just a depressive slog wherein like a supposed doctor. So it's in the aftermath of the big scuffle at the airport, and so Blackjack and Dr. Professor Scientist are just sort of loitering around the waste, like a whole shitload of nothing happens, wherein they're just like wandering and being depressed. Dr. Professor, well, not really Quisling, because she, like, even in spite of, like, being thrown out on her ass and utterly betrayed by, like, the, like, everything wrong about her home country's ideals, still stands for fascism. And so, like, she's an emotional wreck. Meanwhile, Blackjack is, like, blaming herself for something new. And in incredible amounts of pain, says, yeah, like, well, my code of ethics, like, remains valid. Oh, here's someone I can murder without feeling guilty about it?
Yeah.
Justified murder, just the thing I need to pep myself up. While she's, like, getting completely wasted on pills and speedballing. Like, she's taking depressants and amphetamines at the same time.
These will balance them out. My heart's moving too fast. Better take my heart slowing pills.
Really living the like American trucker life there. And her like physician on hand does nothing to stop it.
Yeah.
In spite of like the only source for all these pills presumably being her and her stuff. Yeah, we fuck around a lot until Horse Deadpool shows up.
Oh no! All right, continue. Sorry, I had a moment of revelation.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sound fine noise when he realizes something bad about the story.
So Clan Malkavian in spiky battle armor horse form shows up to save the day against something basically inconsequential and is now added to the party. This is the horse that like gave Blackjack supplies earlier by way of like mass killing. Blackjack goes into anaphylactic shock, and well, Sombra would have you believe that it was a dead horse, a horse pool that saved the day. That's clearly nonsense because there's a doctor on hand. So executive decision we've made on the part of the author that we're reading. Dr. Professor Scientist helps her through her like overdose.
Yeah.
Withdrawal. And then they continue on. At some point, another memory orb is accessed, which gives us information that I can't recall, and so we'll assume it's essentially useless. It was more
pretty much
filler. We get to some kind of town. Blackjack has another sort of fit and has to be gotten to an auto dock, so they rush into town, and another executive decision. Push the resident physician aside.
Yes.
Because they have like an expert bioengineer on hand.
Yeah, a prodigy doctor, as stated by Glory and everyone that's ever talked to about her.
So of course, Somber made the correct decision to like highlight that, like show not, you know, show let more show less tell. We decided that Dr. Professor Scientist, not some rando, found out that Blackjack has the Shadowlands taint.
Yeah, basically.
Has somehow contracted worm taint.
She has sci-fi cancer.
Sci-fantasy cancer, yeah. And we have no idea why yet, though, spoilers, it turns out to be Oppenheimer, Trottenheimer's magic gun. That's about it. We were super sad about it. We were, like, most... I think the main recap of last episode, it was super boring and really rough on us having to contend with, like... The revelations of like the we'll talk about it at the end of the show, but like the major themes that just keep hammering home, and like
the one last little bit of the recap that will lead into from here was that BJ at the end of the chapter wakes up out of another memory orb in a hotel room with a bomb collar strapped to her neck, with being menaced by the two other survivors, other two like escapees from Stable 99.
Uniquizzling and probably should have done this a long time ago.
the stud who is always correct. But yeah, I guess I should get into the perks that we somehow earned despite these boring filler chapters. In chapter 14, we gain, because of all the drugs she took, we gain the perk Chemist, which allows it so that drugs last twice as long.
Sorry, I'm just remembering like a sort of generic stand-up comic I saw when I was a teenager, like playing on like a loop of a handful of stand-up routines on Comedy Central back in the day, where they did a bit of like, no, my parents are Mexican, I am brown, but like expecting me to like do good in Spanish class is like expecting the meth head to be good in chemistry.
Yeah.
Whoops, I guess that logic applies.
Well, it's like the tough hide thing. She's accustomed to bullets now because she's shot by so many of them. She is now accustomed to chems because she's been shot up with so many of them. Even though that's not how chemicals work when you put them in your body.
They last longer. So I guess no, we could just chalk it up to a quirk of pastel horse biology. That instead of developing a tolerance, pastel horses always.
Oh, that means on your 15th Advil, you just die in this universe.
Well, no, on your 15th Advil, you become immune to pain.
Forever. Oh, boy. Yeah, it's...
Medication becomes more effective the more you take it. Like, I wonder if homeopathy works in Pony World. Like,
probably. Get your onion juice, folks. Anyways, so the other perk that she gains this from last week is Hit the Deck, which is she takes less damage from explosions after they blew up a fireworks factory. Again, it really contributes to this long-going narrative of BJ becomes resilient to things after being exposed to them. So yeah, she needs to set herself on fire and become immunized to like fire, because apparently this is how this works now. Oh man, perks are dumb. I think I've said this every like other week, but perks are fucking stupid, and I think they're one of the weaker elements of the storytelling. But they're tradition, so they have to be in it. But I guess that should lead us into chapter 16, Walk the Hard Road, which is our big emotional climax of the first book. So strap in, folks. I do want to just make one nitpick that is not really consequential, but still kind of. I noticed it on a reread. In Fall of Equestria, K-Cat ends all of her volumes with a phrase chapter title instead of a single word title. And this is done again in this case, too, because, like, again, the story has an inferiority complex. It's not really a big deal. It's just another one of those, like, oh, even the chapters have to be copied out of a Fall of Equestria. That's neat. But anyways, this chapter is going to be really goddamn hard to talk about, mainly because it's primarily mostly one big gunfight. And the style I've kind of been adopting for these chapters is to largely ignore fights out of virtue of them being really boring and tedious. And while this one is one of the better ones, with air quotes, because of some of, like, some actual proper, like, action movie tension, it's still really, really, like, hard to talk about because it's hard not to glaze over on these things. Anyways, to get into the text for tonight. We open back up on with BJ being menaced by the Uniquisling with a detonator. Who insists that he now has power over her. And 21 is just kind of sitting there sort of like as sort of a neutral agent right now. U21 makes all sorts of kind of wild threats, and then BJ just kind of like retaliates by saying, basically just repeating all the things that we've seen in the story up till now, as a long laundry list of all of the ways that she no longer cares and also not to be fucked with, which gets 21 to sort of like panic back off. When he realizes the detonator probably isn't actually going to, like, threaten her. Though she tries to call the bluff and say, oh, also, I can almost guarantee you that 21 put a fake bomb on my neck. And 21's like, no, that's a real bomb caller. And she's like, oh. Well, I want to die anyway, so who cares?
What the fuck did you just say about me, you little bitch? I'll have you know I graduated at the top of my class in small town. bully, like, thug cop. I was involved in numerous secret raids.
Yeah, exactly. It's internet tough guy. Oh, man, it's beautiful. This scene is so dumb.
She probably does have over 300 confirmed kills at this point, though. That's...
Well, we know from the, at least after the killing the children, it's at least 60 up to that point. And that was chapters ago.
Okay.
But U21 kind of gives up his attempt and backs off on her. BJ just duct tapes the detonator down so that it doesn't detonate, because it's a dead man switch kind of thing. If they stop holding the trigger down, it'll go off. But
the bomb is real, but yes. They don't have the guts to use it.
Yes. Well, 21 doesn't want to use it. And U21 like realizes he loses his bargaining chip if BJ dies, because like they have a little bit of a conversation with U21 about this, that like he's basically like, I'm fucked. I basically stabbed everyone in the back, and now Deus doesn't give a shit. He'll just kill me the moment like 21 like BJ is up for grabs or whatever. So this was kind of his last chance to like bring her in on his own terms and maybe make a deal so that he doesn't get killed and like. Realizes that he just is fucked 10 ways from Sunday.
What a couple of losers. Those are idiots. Like, okay.
Yeah, U21 sucks.
Like, you might as well just take the bomb off at this point. Like,
yeah. Oh, well, there's a big
reason
why. Really
just made her into a suicide bomber. Like, this is not, like, now she has the leverage. You losers.
Idiots, you just made me stronger. Now I'm even more... Now I'm not a gun, I'm a bomb.
Like, I actually... I don't know. In another story, like in a more self-aware story, I would actually love to see, like, sort of a lunatic, depressive character, like, we've attached a bomb to your neck, attached to this dead man's trigger. Give me that. What? Just snapping.
This is now mine. You gave me a whole extra gun, you idiots. But anyways, a lot of BJ and 21's, like, reconcile, and it's all pretty amicable, even though they kind of left on pretty bad terms, because, like, last time BJ talked to 21, 21 was, like, trying to blow up a mine owner for revenge, and they have a big argument over, like, the difference between revenge and justice. And this is, of course, after BJ's realized that she's a monster, and she kind of infers this without right stating that that she's realized this.
They're just having this sort of amicable conversation about, like, the ethics of killing while she has, like, a bomb collar, like,
yeah.
that he put there. Like,
yep.
I don't... How do you pretend you have the moral high ground with anybody while they have the bomb collar you strapped to them? This story is fun. We have fun here at the podcast. Fanfic podcast.
The fanfic podcast. Anyways, so then they have a sort of reconciliation, and there's kind of a... It's an interesting writing moment, but, like, it's like, eh. Where BJ is having a conversation and apologizes to U21 about the nature of the stable and how fucked up it is. It's kind of obvious that it's meant for both of them, but because of the sort of, like, awkward conversation circumstances they're in, BJ can't just, like, openly admit her actual horrible complicity in it. Like, it's actually a bit of, like, tense writing because it's more complicated than typically the dialogue is in this story. Yeah, U21, it, like, kind of just sort of, like, I don't know, sort of to a degree accepts her apology for her complicitness in the fucked up system. U21 begins to open up and give us some actual plot exposition, when instead room service knocks on the door, which they open up, and it's a pair of twins in hotel garb. This is going to get where it gets really confusing to talk about, because a lot of this is just a fight scene, but, like, there is still conversation and shit that's happening. But anyways, to make a very long drawn-out section short, the pair of twins are a pair of bounty hunters. They're members of the Zodiac clan, named Jem and Minnie, so they're Gemini together. Their particular bounty hunter special power is that they can make themselves intangible to things, so they're basically immune to bullets, bombs, explosions, and...
Wait, Jem and what again?
Minnie, so Gemini.
Right there. That's the worst way you can do it. I hate this author personally.
He's committed word crime. Broken.
Okay.
But anyways, they're a pair of intangible gunslingers who. The only real way that they can deal with them is that...
Oh, they're the fucking, like, ghost guys from The Matrix Reloaded?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, they're even, like, basically albinos as well, so, yeah.
Okay.
Yep, you're just gonna have to take this as it is.
No, like, look, like, I now respect the artistic decision for the incredibly shitty name, because I'm now over that, like... I am now beyond the reference. It's okay.
It's such all a quick well. Move past it. But yeah, they're also being backed up by one of their other brothers in the Zodiac family named Taurus, who just uses explosives and isn't really present in the story in any real way. But anyways, they have kind of a crazy gunfight where they have to, like, maneuver around a pair of characters who can walk through walls, which is actually pretty fun. But the consequence of this as well is also that in the ensuing gunfight, U21 takes a whole lot of bullets because he's now narratively, like, expendable in the story. His dying words are to mouth some cryptic bullshit about he references another project, which is Project Chimera, which is okay, guys, because they lampshade how dumb it is for someone to die with their cryptic words as their last words. So it's totally okay to make this decision. It's not frustrating at all. It's to take a moment just to complain about U21 specifically. U21 is incredibly frustrating because he's kind of presented as, like, what if 21 was, like, a bad guy? Because he's essentially in the same circumstances that, like, P21 was, but he, like, doesn't tolerate, like, women in the same way that, like, P21 does, and therefore needs to be exterminated, I guess. And he also has no clear, like, arc to him. Like, he's just, like, a scheming rat that dies for to be punished vicariously for his, like, treason, essentially, and is just really shitty and one-dimensional and, like, kind of a waste of a character in general. Not cool. Not cool, Somber. It's not like I like him, it's just like it's one of those things where it's like he could have been, like, nothing in the rules says this character could have, like, had to be bad.
Yeah.
You just wrote him bad.
So many things could have been done with this character, and they were not.
Anyways, old, like, I just wrote here, old, like, Old West gunfight time. Because this whole, like, a lot of this is very reminiscent of the, like, kind of, like, climax gunfight of so many Westerns where, like, there's just a lot of wild, loud chaos, sort of occurring. They escape the hotel because they, like, the Zodiacs blow up their hotel and they escape on it in a cast iron tub surfing down the staircase. Which is a cool, like, aesthetic, but it's really crazy to think about. And they don't get a moment to breathe because they're getting barreled down on by the by Deus and his cronies as well, coming from the north. They manage to get behind some wagons that are being that the bar pony that they met earlier, and some security guards are hiding behind, also having this gunfight. This is also when that gang that they fucked with also decide to, like, storm the town at the same time. So they're being, like, hounded from three different angles all at the same time. Bar Horse gives them, like, a tip of how to get into the town, which is convoluted, but basically, like, the top of one of the buildings has, like, a pipe bridge that comes out of it, which is a very, like, common architecture in, like, the Fallout universe specifically. So, like, I don't fault them for having buildings that just have pipe bridges in them for no reason. But this whole section is actually kind of fun, but I can't explain except for by doing a play-by-play of, like, why I think it's fun. But it's just because it's, like, a very, like, it's a running race where they have to get to a location. And there's a lot of, like, chaos in a good way kind of happening.
Maybe in the future, go ahead and put like, select quotes in your notes.
Yeah. I have some here, but, like, I just mean, like, in general, like, my broad point about this particular chapter is that, like, it's not terrible. It's just, like, sort of hard to convey in radio, I guess is my point. But anyways, on their way up to the roof of the market, they hit into the second floor of that place, which is a club, which I didn't explain when we first got into town because, like, it wasn't relevant then. It's only kind of relevant right now because it allows for a really crazy gunfight inside of a, like, modern, like, I don't know what you call it, like, modern, like, EDM club. Like, there is a bit where they get help from what is essentially a pair of, like, Daft Punk, like, XBs to play loud, chaotic music and distract the Pecos from fighting them. They have a gunfight on a glowy dance floor, which is, again, it's a good kind of energetic and chaotic. Like, it's mad, but in a good way. Hmm. It's that action movie kind of mad. It's the kind of scene that if it was shot in a movie, it would be ruined by, like, fast cuts. But, like, the premise is there. Anyways, Rampage falls into the ceiling onto the dance floor and does her "I'm the cool murder pony" thing. She takes a shotgun to the face for it, which does not kill her. Unfortunately, she just spits out some buckshot and her eyes are missing. And she muddles something about I hate having to regrow my eyes. And Beach is like, "How did you live through that?" And she's like, "I'm really hard to kill."
Oh no!
Yeah,
it's more a horse pool than I had ever imagined.
Oh,
fully
boy.
Armed and operational horse pool.
A weapon to surpass horse pool.
A weapon to surpass X. Weapon X. Yeah.
Low-hanging fruit. Low-hanging fruit.
The best. Juicy.
Fruit. Anyways, they get up onto the next floor and they kind of, like, duck into an unused room that had been, like, junk had been piled up in front of it. Glory and 21 get into an argument over the fact that BJ is still wearing the damn bomb collar because Glory joined the fight during the music hall conflict. And Glory kind of calls out 21 for insisting it stays on, but BJ agrees with 21 insisting on it staying on because it's a complicated metaphor about punishment for her actions. It is potentially valuable in the sense that she is essentially giving him the option to, like, hold her accountable for her actions, but, like, it's again a problem of hyperbole and extreme. Like, it's the idea that the only way she can, like, be cleared of her crimes is actually just death, which is, like, a really poor, like, it's a unfortunate problem of our modern, like, incarceration system. But, like, yeah, BJ won't budge about the bomb collar being on. Rampage basically just goes, "Go on ahead, I'll go fight the rest of the ground units while you kids get out of here. I don't even want to talk about this, but it's a fucking absurd foreshadowing moment. But on their way up, they get helped by a bunch of drugged out ponies that are strung out on a kind of drug called moon dust. Which again, I wouldn't bring up except for the fact that it's foreshadowing. But anyways, they end up in this closed room that leads up to the roof, where we get the whole really cool fight that I've been talking about that I've been enjoying up to this point gets ground to a halt and so bad it ruins a lot of it for me. Where they're doing a little cool off in this closed room, and they find out that this room was owned by some sort of musician horse, and her terminal like plays an automatic recording. She was a musician that was blacklisted for holding like an anti-war concert. And this is an interesting premise, but it's just incredibly like misplaced in this moment. Like it shouldn't be in this chapter 16 because it's theoretically they should be like the climax of the arc, and this kind of just backstory exposition should have been saved either for an earlier chapter or a later chapter.
I don't know. I'm deeply amused, but like, I can only imagine it is either like it could only be deeply frustrating to have to read or incredibly hilarious. All right, so in the middle of this gunfight, here's this bar and why it's here and its tragic history.
Yeah, I just found it incredibly frustrating, personally. But it's an interesting concept, though, of a musician being like blacklisted for basically being like, hey, like maybe war is bad. It's one of the very few times where like the ministries are actually called out in a way that is like reflective of real life. They then get onto the roof, and it's like the realization is that the pipe bridge is actually like slightly below the roof by like a story or two. So they're gonna have to like finagle their way onto it. So there's a really like tense scene of them moving on the dilapidated broken roof while being shot at by horses and
exquisite out of context.
Yeah. This is a tense scene.
Just the phrase alone, being shot while being shot at by horses. in any other context. That would make for this a vastly more interesting.
and horses were there, and they were also shooting. But yeah, but then we get another fucking out of nowhere. Like, doesn't stop the story dead, but it's just confusing that it's here. But while this is all happening, out of goddamn nowhere, a fucking enclave horse just shows up slightly below their position, and BJ makes the smart decision to jump them. From the roof.
Okay.
Oh, it gets dumber. Give me a minute. She tackles this horse onto the top of the pipe bridge and starts beating them up with rebar and basically almost murders them by getting the drop on them. Up until Glory stops her, and we get the reveal that dun dun dun. This is Glory's older sister, Dusk. After finding out that her sister had become a Dash Knight and ruined their family, is going to take some sweet sweet revenge. They have a long conversation with Dusk, and Dusk is twice as bought into the fascism and party line as Glory is. Like, Glory sounds like an anarchist in comparison. They manage to talk her down from murder up to, instead she's going to report Glory being, like, KIA, and hopefully that can recover some of, like, the clout that their family, like, has, and their lives, their livelihoods won't be ruined by this, like, sudden traitor in their family. And then she just flies away. So, like, I don't know why that was in this chapter. I feel like the reason why is because the narrative, like, tie up everyone's loose ends in a sort of, like, that way we get all of our eggs in a basket. But, like, why, though? Why is this here?
I don't know. Frenetic chaos? The stakes weren't high enough.
I guess.
But like if they have like time enough to negotiate that, then actually it does, like, I can't imagine how it doesn't sort of eat into the momentum of, like,
oh, it really does. She does a solid by blasting a couple of people that are trying to get up, that managed to get themselves onto the bridge. Okay, so now we're getting to the sort of climax of this particular chapter. Okay. So they get onto the pipe bridge proper. It's a super busted ass pipe bridge. It's actually a pretty good, cool aesthetic area to have a fight in. Jem and Minnie reappear in fight, and it's a and fight them. It's a pretty engaging fight because of the like the intangibility is used really well. Like there's so much debris in the area that like BJ can barely move around, and like the characters are just no clipping through everything, and beating the shit out of her with weapons that like she can't stop. But this ends up being their downfall because the 21, who's our explosive expert, drops a...
He is now.
Yeah, he's our explosives expert. He's our lockpick master and explosives expert.
Okay, yes.
Well, before you see, he rigged the detonator. He
yes, drops a... okay, yes. Yes. Okay. I mean, a lot of perks have been gained.
Yeah.
And perhaps he also was in the proximity of a firecracker.
I suppose.
So, and so Mega Man-like, he absorbed its powers.
I have feasted on the dynamite. It is now part of me.
I now understand it. I am one with it. And it is as it is with me. The dynamite floated up to him and said, "Thou art I, and I art thou."
Oh, man, I'm never going to get through this chapter, but I don't even care. Who cares? But anyways, they drop the magical equivalent of an EMP grenade on the sisters, which cancels out their spell. And one of them happened to be in the middle of a wall while that happened, so she gets body stuck in a wall. She gets telefragged by a wall.
Like, but she, does that immediately kill her, or is she just... like?
No, she's just in it.
Okay.
She's lodged in it, but like her, she's going to die kind of situation. Like it's one of those things that's remarkable about like organic bodies is like you can live through a lot of horrible bullshit, and being separated in half doesn't necessarily kill you right away.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Now what I was trying to get at is like because the idea of like magically like phasing through things is completely like scientifically impossible and implausible. Like there's a bunch of different ways that different series like handle the rules of what happens if you like are stopped midway, and so I guess this is the variation where like okay, you've been stopped midway. Well, you've been stopped in the middle of phasing through a wooden wall. That wall is now like partially slurry. Like a slurry of organ and wood.
Yeah, see, I'm actually not sure now that we've brought this up though, because she specifically says the phrase to her sister, "It doesn't hurt, it's okay." And I initially just turned that, like, interpreted that as, like, her legs are now, like, devoid of feeling because her spine is now in half. But it could easily just be the other way, where it's just, like, her and the debris are now one.
Or it could just be, like, you know, a lot of them, like if it were a kid's show, then, like, the wood would be displaced around her.
Regardless, she's hopelessly stuck and basically dead. This gets the Zodiacs to give up because they care more about family than money. They basically go, we give you we don't want to lose another over this shit. But unfortunately the sentimentality is lost because Deus also manages to make his way up onto the pipe bridge as well. And of course because he's a bad guy mocks their like familial weakness. Tauros, the third family member, tries to stop him, and he gets blown up by the cannon, by one of Deus's cannons for his efforts. He dies in a very like intentionally anticlimactic way, like the way the prose is written is meant to be like as understated as possible to like maximize like how spontaneous like gone he is. It's a common trick, but it's you know, effective in this case. But anyways, 21 hatches a smart big boy brain plan while BJ is distracting Deus by like unhooking the bomb collar off of him and basically like, "Hey, give me some time," and distract him long enough for something. And I misremembered this scene as being way cooler than it actually is, so get ready to be disappointed just as much as I am. BJ gets knocked away by oh, okay, so no, gotta back up. Her plan of distracting him is she slides under his like horsey undercarriage and shoots him in the dick.
Okay.
Because it's the one place he can't like regenerate or heal because it's not robotic. And Hela just loses it, obviously, on her after being shot in the dick. He chases her into the other building from the pipe bridge. And then this is where the scene gets, like, really kind of sucky. Because then the other twin, Jem, just levitates herself in front of Deus with the bomb collar and detonator and then just in a bunch of dynamite and just blows his head off with it. And I misremembered this as the whole point of this intangibility thing was she phases the bomb collar into him because that just makes more sense narratively to me. Like, oh yeah,
He can like weather anything. So like,
yeah, like if the gun is going to be a no cell, then like how does dynamite hurt him? And it's like, I guess I just remembered. Like I just assumed by like the rule of threes, it was going to be like, oh yeah, Deus is shown to be able to be vulnerable to explosions.
No, like you remembered it correctly, but you read it wrong this time.
Yeah, you're right.
Just like that weird quirk where like there was some sort of weird typo where it like said horse pool like treated gave the treatment for like a drug overdose. Your memory is correct. It was a clever thing that only a phasing person could do. Like the entire point of having a goddamn phasing person here is to supplant the explosives under his plating.
Yes.
So yeah, good work, Somber. That's a very clever insert.
You did a good ending to this Deus character. But yeah, he has a pretty horrific death because he's immolated and most like all of his meat parts are now gone. And he's basically just mechanical. Like it's the end of Terminator 1 where like the Terminator is just metal and it's like making its last like death throes as a horrible mechanical phoenix. And it takes this last moment of desperation before it finally dies. But yeah, but with that all being the case, BJ goes back to the last remaining member of the Zodiacs and basically plans to mercy kill her and can't go through with it. The Zodiac horse takes it on herself to fire the gun for her, removing the agency of the action from BJ and then apologizing to her and in the same act apologizing to her about the what they've been doing and also that she's a better person than she thinks she is, which is a lie, you know. It's a story. Like she doesn't know that. Like Minnie doesn't know that BJ's a horrible monster. But anyways, that would be a really cool ending to a chapter, but because Somber sucks at ending chapters, we have to get the actual final reconciliation between the two. Well, no, actually, I scratched that. Like, this is the actual emotional core of this last book, so this I guess this does have to be included here. BJ finds 21 in the wreckage again, like, throws a gun at his feet and basically is like, all right, you know, do it. I know what I did to you now, and, like, I can't be forgiven. So we get a very, very tense moment of 21, you know, pulling the gun on her and straining to consider actually killing her. It's a very Old West kind of final moment in a chapter where, and then he instead makes the decision to spit out the gun
because they're filleting their firearms.
Yeah, he's an earth horse.
Makes the entire like gun battle all the fucking stupider.
Yeah, in almost all those gun battles, at least half of the characters had guns in their mouths. So you got tricked this time. You forgot that we're in Pastel Flesh Horse Town. But, Christ. So I had to bring up this section because I need to sort of read this out in full, these next two paragraphs, because it's unbelievable, because this is where we get, like, our sort of theme. So BJ asks, like, why don't you kill me? For what I've done to you and everyone else has done. And he responds with, I wanted to. I still want to a little. And I don't think that'll ever go away. I still see it, still feel it. And no matter what, that murder and Stable 9 are part of me. He said as he bowed his head, then looked at me. But for as long as I've known you, I've known you're something special. You could have killed both of us out of spite, out of sadistic glee. I know Daisy would have. You could have left Daisy to take me. You could have left me for Deus when we fled 99. You could have killed Scoodle and blamed her for her death. You could have left the killing of 40 psychotic foals up to me or glory. You just fought the scariest fucking monster in the wasteland while trying to defend three ponies that were out to kill you, Blackjack. Time and time again, the wasteland gives you the easiest path and you refuse to take it. You could have just given up EC-1101 over. You could have just not cared about 99. You could have just let me die, or the Crusaders, or Glowy. You take the hard road, no matter how much it hurts. And I can only watch in awe as I watch you keep walking it. And every time I think you're going to do what's wrong and easy, you surprise me. I couldn't do it. I would have to cut a deal the second I left Stable 99. But you're sticking it out, trying to find out what makes this damned thing work so important. You walk the hard road, Blackjack, and sorry, but you deserve this. And then he hugs her. He fucking hugs her. This chapter ends with a big hug moment after, like, the craziest goddamn shit.
I mean, you know, things have settled down. We're, like... and now, like, the, if there were any time for a hug moment, I guess that would be it. It falls flat for me because, like, all of these, like, situations are so, just, like, he lists off a checklist of the incredibly contrived scenarios, we have experienced thus far. In each case, you didn't do like the worst thing.
you did the least you could do, Blackjack. Good for you. Gold star for you. The one valuable thing about this is that he insists that he can forgive him. He can forgive what she did to him because it's just part of the stable, which already has its own problems, which we'll talk about in a bit. But he can't forgive her for U-20, the guy from before, his lover, which I can, like, respect kind of as a narrative decision. Like, there are actions that really aren't forgivable no matter what. And that's kind of like, yeah, there's not really much you can do about that. You can't unkill somebody. God, I just quoted Full Equestria to prove a point about Project Horizons. That's where I am right now. By the way, Calamity's the best character ever, and I strongly recommend reading Fall Equestria just for Calamity. This has become a Calamity podcast.
I am here for anarchist horses. Anarchist, yes. cowboy anarchist horses.
But his big point is you can't unkill someone. Like, that's a big thing about specifically Calamity is his character. There are things you can make up for, like killing people isn't one of them. But anyways, that's our chapter. We're gonna launch into our larger view after that, but take a moment, because this is our self-care corner. Take a moment, get a snack, hug a cat, get some pillows, go for a run, get some exercise, take a nap. Remember, if you have any medication that you're forgetting to take, consider taking it. Be nice to people.
Within some limits, like, you know, go ahead and self-medicate. Like, with, you know, if you've got, like, sugar or, like, something harmless that you don't isn't particularly habit-forming, like, go ahead and take some of that.
Have a coffee, smoke some weed. Do what makes you happy. But anyways, we are going to now launch into our sort of book one review of the story so far through this really bizarre folk retelling of this work. So I just kind of jotted around a couple of points that I think are important to kind of discuss between me and Weird, and we'll see where we go from there. So my first big point that came to me initially is that I want to talk about that I kind of want to restate from the very beginning of this story is that Somber doesn't really understand feminism or feminist ethos, and he doesn't understand the notion of, like, gender disparity in any real way. Like, a very common cliche that a lot of, like, people who are either ambivalent or directly anti-feminist is that they, like, actively misunderstand what feminist goals and ideology even are, and they just presume that they want a, like, reversal of power structures instead of, like, an egalitarian, like, redistribution of power. So when you get characters like 21, who is the closest we have to a feminist, he's essentially the bizarro fantasy version of a like in our universe he'd be red pill, but I guess like he's kind of a lefty, like in the way, like if we're going from this crazy nonsense universe. But he's basically a rad femme. Like his sense of feminism, because he's a fictional character, is the grossest kind of turfism or rad feminism, where he despises women out and out, which is, you know, understandable in the text of the work, but like the problem with that is, again, I say this in chapter in episode one, and I'll say this every episode it comes up.
It's only that way because of the author's choice. The author, like,
yeah,
made the world this way, set up this scenario.
We had to construct an elaborate, nightmarish stable where all women hold all positions of power, and therefore, like, excise a ton of power and oppression onto males, which it's already problematic because of, like, the presentation of it being so extreme. Like, this is a very common, like, a common line of thinking with a lot of anti-feminists, is that they believe that, like, feminists are irrelevant, especially third-string feminists, like third-wave feminists, because feminism is not necessary because women have the vote now, and women have essential equality, so, like, it's no longer necessary. So, in their heads, when they want to construct, an elaborate fantasy version of it, they have to make a version of it where, like, oppression is obvious, direct, and, like, not subtle in any real significant way, which...
There's no such thing as a microaggression, only macro... Only physical violence.
Mega aggression.
Only physical violence constitutes aggression.
But yeah, it's a significant point that I've always wanted. Like, I've always felt about the story is 21. A lot of 21's rhetoric feels very hollow when you think about the real world and how it applies. Even from his presentation, he doesn't get like any form of egalitarianism. He just wants, like, justice. And his concept of justice is very, like,
retributionary.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I'm forgetting words left and right today. Restorative.
Yeah, restorative justice, reparation. But he mellows out in later chapters when he just becomes a gay cowboy. But, like, that's the thing too, is that, like, I don't know if Somber realized this was the problem and was trying to, like, correct this, and this is actually, like, a thought out arc, or it's just he got tired of wanting to write a character who's this extreme all the time. Yeah, that was sort of my big point with it, is that he doesn't get feminism, and this elaborate scenario created is purely Thermian and, like, sort of irrelevant and shitty. And it's also, like, also it's not taken far enough. Because he doesn't understand microaggression, Blackjack isn't sexist, she's just a rapist. Like, which is confusing as a, I guess, a mindset to think about, but she has no internalized misandry about other people. She just ignorant of, like, sexual violence, which is, like, bizarre. Like, it presents the idea that, like, oh, these people are just ignorant and they would, like, get woken up to it, and there's no deliberate, like, violence on the head of your oppressors, which is also terrible. Like, that's a big problem a lot of the left struggles with, is the idea that, like, the right wants to eat you, and they would do so on camera if they had the choice. Their frame of, like, perspective is not yours, and it's not that they're ignorant, they are just actually malicious. And it's definitely the case in this sort of stuff with feminism. It's like, it's a fascinating case because, like, the author doesn't get feminism but wants to portray what is essentially a feminist protagonist in 21. So he's the most rad femme, like, turf swerf fucking asshole ever. That was my sort of point on that. Weird, do you have any other thoughts on specifically, like, Sombra's problematic feminism, or anti-feminism rather, or shall I move on?
Give me just a moment.
Yep. Yeah, this is gonna be a little bit more of a laid back, like, back half of this podcast, because we're really just kind of discussing our thoughts and feelings on chapters for now.
So good on him for not, like, there's still, like, plenty of technically significant female characters present. Like, there isn't I haven't noticed particularly any strong, like, expectation of roles. Like gender roles don't play, like, a huge impact on the actual, like, politics presented in the story, besides P21's, you know, sort of red pill MGTOW kind of rants.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good thing. That's a positive to note. Beyond that, like, based on what's been recounted to me, the only real sticking point is P21's entire ethos, and presented as the character who's right about everything, and the things that he is apparently right about, included in that, like, category is creepy MGTOW rants. So
yeah, he is. Got powerful incel energy. But yeah, I guess that I'll launch in my next point. Point number two. A lot of book one has a lot of, like, framing issues in general with the way it does anything. But very specifically, it is okay if BJ is a terrible person, if it's called to attention and is also primarily about her retributive, like her, not retributive, her redemptive arc. The problem with it is that the story does a very bad job of making that redemptive arc demonstrable, which is really just an excuse for me to say the word demonstrable, because BJ has a really baffling arc, and we'll get into this more in later chapters as well. We have what is essentially, she as a child, she was initially a wide-eyed idealist who genuinely believed in the cops, like essentially the security force's efforts of helping people. The security force has a rhetoric in the story, which is security saves ponies. She fundamentally, as a child, believed in the idea of like them as an inherent force of good, and then was then inevitably beaten down by that expectation by her actually attempting to enact the sort of goal implied by the security save ponies by trying to arrest people that are corrupt and stopping things that are happening, and is then eventually beaten down. The problem with that is that framing is still subject to problematic issues because it presents that the alternate is the Dirty Harry ethos of you should have just thrown in your badge and become a rogue cop and did it your own way, which has a lot of issues in real life with cops bucking rules to kill people, especially minorities. So that kind of leaves a bad taste in my mouth. But again, there's technically nothing wrong with making BJ basically a monster who has to like learn to be better. But a lot of the issue is it just does not show how she comes to these conclusions. Like she's presented that these things are bad, but like as fucked as up as it would have been to include, like there's no actual sexual violence in this story from any character that is like dismissed except for from Stable 99. Like we're not shown societies which accept sexual violence as like a regular thing or are directly opposed to it. Actually, we are, but not until very late into the story, which is actually frustrating now that I think about it, because one of the gangs in Goosestepsburg is specifically a gang of sexual violence survivors that have banded together to protect each other. They are wasteland feminists, I guess, in a horrible fucked up society. But so far, like I don't want to say doesn't feel earned, because saying things aren't felt earned in a narrative gets into a lot of dumb story policing problems. Like, oh, I didn't feel like that transformation of this character felt really justified or earned is a common sticking point for a lot of, like, critics, with air quotes, of film and literary works. But we're just simply not shown enough to really justify BJ's turn. Sorry, go ahead.
I have some specific thoughts on this, which is that BJ's characterization is a mess. Particularly because I feel that like her characterization in flashbacks is sort of oh so convenient her entire characterization changes on a dime depending upon Sombra's immediate needs. There's lots of rooms to tell a redemption story wherein like sort of a callous, terrible person like turns over a new leaf, and then there's a story you could tell about somebody just struggling with self-doubt. That, like, you know, bad self-talk. But things get real muddled when you try and combine them. And particularly when, like, your characterization isn't consistent. So, like, the problem we currently have is that seems to be trying to do both. That, like, okay, this is a person who comes from, like, a hideous system and they have to, like, learn to be better. And at the same time, they're struggling with depression and negative self-talk. And so you can very easily wind up with a situation that I think we have here wherein, whoops, you're trying to balance spin both of those places at the same time, and instead you wind up validating a bad character. Yes. Here's a bad person who has a lot of negative self-talk, and when you emphasize solving their negative self-talk problem, that justifies the terrible things this terrible person does. The things that made this person, like, bad. When you focus your efforts on, like, getting them over their negative image of themselves, above trying to sort out like what the bad things they did were,
mm-hmm.
you wind up justifying the bad things that, like, yes. when you tell like a person who is like guilty of deeply terrible things that it is all right to like forgive themselves, it gives it, it innately, like, the optics of that
Are poor.
Yeah. So advice to storytellers out there, you should probably stick to doing one of those things.
Yeah.
Or one and then the other.
Yeah.
The flashbacks of, like, what Blackjack's history, actual history with P-21 actually was, it feels incredibly forced. Like, it's just like the you have to kill these babies.
Yeah.
Situation. But again, like, so I think we've talked about it before, but the goal of Blackjack as a character is someone to feel miserable.
Yeah.
To dump a lot of anxieties on. I don't know, it almost makes one want to make a case for, like, an unreliable narrator. Like, this is a person who is, like, deep in the sauce of bad self-talk and on drugs an awful lot as well.
Yeah.
Hearing the story from their perspective, so it's entirely possible that they are, like, massively inflating what actually happened in their first, you know, interaction there. Like, if this is a character who is, like, in the habit of shitting on themselves, then I guess it makes sense that they would, like, inflate their interaction with their first, like, mating with a love slave as, oh, I was so callous and awful. But I mean, the text doesn't support that. It doesn't sound like, it's just very clear that, like, okay, no, this you like, here is a recording of somebody else talking.
Young Blackjack is very odd because she's basically a monster. Like, the turn of her being, like, kind of a callous monster growing up to be, like, lazy and indolent is a confusing one as an arc.
Because it isn't one. Like again, like, it's, I think we're overthinking it.
Yeah, no, I know.
Because that like, we're assuming some thought went into that when, like, okay, we're given this initial characterization for convenience, like, for the torture, the torture porn to work. This character has to be exposed to, like, unthinkable actions that for unexplained reasons they can't remember, and for unexplained reasons they no longer empathize with. They no longer, like, understand emotionally. It's not a confusing plot point. It's a dumb contrivance, more likely.
Yeah, it's bad writing. But as an audience, we can't help but, like, try to knit them together and make them make sense as a body of work.
Because that's how human brain work. Yeah. Human brain want connection. Want make sense.
Yeah.
Create pattern. No pattern found. Make pattern.
Make pattern. Invent pattern. Null cloth. There's another point. I kind of want to make. Not nearly as hard, but it's, like, just kind of something I noticed is that the story normalizes mercy killings and suicidal ideation a lot. Very specifically, it always frames them, like, it frames mercy killing as, like, the like, the caring option to do, and it frames suicidal ideation as, like, positive as long as it's productive. Like, time and time again, characters are put on situations where they'll die excruciating deaths that they'll can only really be saved by BJ, like, making the call and killing them. But that is a problem that isn't as interesting, in my opinion, as the secondary point I've made of this. Of one of the biggest problems with BJ as a character is that she is constantly cognitively dissonant, like, she is or distorted. She is obviously and utterly depressed in almost all circumstances, and she spends almost all of her time second-guessing, minimalizing, breaking down all of her points into worse ones. But
catastrophizing.
Yeah, and catastrophizing. But it's constantly framed as is, it's okay as long as she has some sort of ethos to keep her going. Like, the story brings up the concept of virtues not very well, but virtues actually, like, are valuable as a sort of a thematic framing device in the story, as it presents the idea that, like, to have a virtue is to keep yourself from breaking to the ways and becoming an unrestrained killer. But the way it's presented in this story is that virtues are valuable because it's the only thing keeping you, a person who wants to die constantly, from wanting to die. Which, you know, it's, you know, I have depression. Like, I understand the mechanisms of why that happens. Like, it's easy to get tricked into thinking that, like, well, I hate myself and want to die, but at least I'm, like, paying rent and I'm giving people money. Or at least, like, my existence contributes to something. Like, my work is valuable, or mine, like the you can't find value in yourself, so you have to find value in the actions you take. But the problem with this specific story is that, like, that it presents it as, like, a moral good to think this way.
Yeah, and I guess that comes back to the end of this chapter of, like, you could have been so much worse, thumbs up. like, yeah. like, not as bad as you could have been, Metal.
Yep. You tried, but it's like the really squiggly MS Paint star.
But that, and laminated on top of a solid gold medal. yeah, no, also, like, I live in the modern world, and I have, like, broken world sucks itis on top of, like, a genetic predisposition to depression, and, like, I think the thing that makes Sombra's perspective alien to me and kind of grotesque is that, like, I hope he, like, gets therapy, or I hope he has, like, the emotional tools in him somewhere to find the actual answer, which is, like, the thing that keeps me going is my connections to people.
Yes.
As opposed to, like, I mean, the baby steps, like, okay, you accomplished a thing, is a valuable, you know, psychological affirmation that, like, you know what, everything sucks, but I made my bed this morning, my bills are paid. Sometimes the bare minimum is a pretty, like, good accomplishment that you should... you shouldn't minimalize.
Yeah.
But!
Well, the thing I would say is that the minimal endorphins wear off eventually. Like, eventually that stops working.
Yeah. But it shouldn't be, like, the end goal. Like, it shouldn't be, like, your destiny. It shouldn't be the goalposts. Like mm-hmm. you should give yourself respect for, like, however far you manage to get, but it shouldn't end there. Shouldn't be, like, the final affirmation of validity. And I guess this really explains the really antisocial, like, cannibal libertarian, like, politics of the rest of the story, is that if our author, or at least the authorial voice, if this story seems to propose that doing the bare minimum is what qualifies as virtue, in terms of just actions that you have taken for your benefit, and not your connections to other people, which is where, like, the traditional notion of most virtues comes from. Like, yeah. Name any given virtue, or name any Catholic sin, and they all relate to your impact on the people around you.
Yeah. The virtues we made really were the friends we made along the way.
And again, the virtues, like, are relate back to the original goddamn My Little Pony in terms of the elements of harmony, the components of friendship. And this is a world that friendship forgot. Like, God. Friendship doesn't, like, factor into, like, an evaluation of moral
That's
character.
A better line than all of Fall of Queership put together. The world friendship forgot.
And so, yeah, if you're utterly alone and intend to stay that way, I guess, then I suppose that the only metric of, like, virtue... you can find is what little you can accomplish for your own benefit. I think in discussing this we've sort of hit upon, like, the core thing that, like, makes everything we've talked about, everything that's happened in the story so far so ethically grotesque to us, is that, like, we're commies who care about the well-being of, like, existences outside of ourselves. Beyond, like, I guess beyond mere validation. But though, paradoxically, that's the whole point. Like, I think it was, is it Hegelian recognition?
Sounds about right. Well, we'll come back to that point. But there's only a couple more points I really want to make. And these are just kind of in not really in a real order of any way. Something else I wanted to touch on is that both Glory and 21 are absolute goddamn messes of characters and are, at least for now, largely irrelevant to the story. Like, Glory more so than anyone. Like, I really, really want to touch on Glory. But just as a secondary point, 21 exists to make BJ's, like, baggage more present and in the real and more consequential by that extension. After this chapter, 21 is essentially the gay best friend. He has virtually almost no other... He has impact in the story. Don't get me wrong. They end up together. Like, I keep pointing that out. They end up together, and it's fucked up. But, like, for a huge chunk of the story, he is the, like, this is the thing, is, like, it, this is a thing about the framing of the story, is that if you don't know this, 21 comes across as a fun character because he's slowly unlearning his hatred of women, at the same time that BJ is unlearning a lot of her own baggage. And at the time, they're constantly snarking at each other, and they're having a lot of fun best friend moments, and they're basically just both disaster gays, which is a big mood, in my opinion. And that stuff's fun, but knowing that, like, the author's like, oh yeah, these characters end up together, like, ruins that momentum. It ruins that good energy that this story has up to that point. And we can never look back. Like, we can.
I know, I for one, I don't know how the audience feels, but I for one appreciate you disarming that bomb, because it would have been an ugly hit to have to.
It's still going to be an ugly hit because Somber doesn't understand polyamory in the slightest, but, like, we'll have to get there when we get there.
Oh, God. Anyway, I still want
to. Yeah, no, go ahead. I just wanted to
talk to you and talk to our audience about. So the philosopher Hegel had this notion of, he put it in incredibly problematic terms, but he's, like, from the, like, 1700s or 1800s, so what are you going to do?
He's from the very racist past, and, like, the very racist present.
So Hegel had this philosophical notion called the master-slave dialectic, which essentially is kind of a refutation of the I think, therefore I am. It's the notion that the long and short of it, at least most people interpret it as a sort of statement that we are defined, our self-image is cultivated by the people around us, that how other people view us is important to forming an identity and meaning and motive. The master-slave dialectic essentially proposes that two consciousnesses encounter each other. One overwhelms the other. They panic in realization that if there is a non-self, then that means that there is a negation of self. There is a self that is not I. And the struggle with this, at least within this specific dialectic, is one identifies themselves as the master, and the other identifies themselves as the slave. And eventually the master has to come to terms with the fact that having the recognition of a slave isn't enough, because you've removed the personhood from this other. That, like, what is the validation of somebody who is obligated to validate you worth? You can't get any truth from that, and so you can't, like, make any deductions about yourself. Like, you can't make any meaningful inference about yourself. And so you find yourself empty in such a case. While the slave, if they're able to break free from identifying themselves only as an extension of the master's identity, doesn't actually need the master. They do all the work. Like, they have built the world with their hands and don't necessarily need instruction in order to do that.
This is called the power bottom philosophy.
But anyway, I've actually massively over-explained it. Hegelian recognition.
It's cool.
Is the main thing I want to talk about.
Go check out Philosophy Tube, folks. They do a much better job of explaining a lot of these kind of.
And they do it theatrically.
Yes.
Increasingly so. It used to be just a head talking to the camera, but it's gotten more exceedingly more fabulous as time goes on.
Now he's the devil. Anyways, there was a couple of more points that I wanted to touch on, and then I wanted to wrap up. This one was just kind of permeated the whole story, and we scratch that. I wanted to go back to talking about Glory, and I want to talk about, like, narrative expendability of a character, and, like, always frustrated by Glory. Like, we're gonna see more of this. Like, I laughed about the meme of Glory is dead is a very persistent meme in the story, because, like, the author doesn't know what to do with her. So her only real, like, tension is, like, almost dying in scenes, which is preposterous given that she's she's presented as supposed to be A, a doctor, B, to some degree, like, proper military training, also some sort of master virtuoso mechanic.
Almost as though she should have been the one to rig up, like, an explosive device.
Yeah.
It's weird. Like, yeah, no, like.
Well, I'll nip that one in the bud.
Actively, like, handing her job out.
The point I will make, and this will really frustrate anyone that understands anything about feminism, Glory is the damsel. That's why. Glory is the girl in the story, despite the, like, despite the gender politics of the story still having, like, a lot of female characters in it. Glory is the girl of the cast. She is waifish. She is impractical. She is awkward amongst the rest of the crew. She is meant to be sort of waifish and feminine while the rest of them aren't, which is baffling, given her initial description is that of, like, buzz-cutted, like, jumpsuit-wearing mechanic when we first see her, to the point where this dissonance is so prevalent that no one, like, of all the fan art that's ever drawn of Glory, no one ever draws her with a buzz cut. No one ever draws her as looking mannish, because to her, because her description is so feminine. Most people, like, we made fun of her accent. When I've talked to other people in this community, most people just assume that she basically just sounds like Fluttershy, because they just assume that she's basically that character, because of how bizarre and waifish she is. Which is either a mistake of the audience or the author. Like, the author doesn't do a very good job of communicating that Glory isn't just a damsel.
If the zeitgeist of the, if the gestalt consciousness of the audience, if the collective unconscious of the audience has this picture in their head, then, like, it didn't come from nobody. It didn't come from no place.
You are totally right. It is definitely because he doesn't do a very good job of articulating. Like, he does, like, that thing, like, a lot of unfortunate male authors do, of just not doing a very good job of, like, penning women being anything besides one-dimensional. Like, BJ might as well not have a gender as far as the story is concerned. Like,
she's a gun.
Yeah, she's a gun.
I mean, yeah, so I fully intend to maintain my strict, almost unhealthy defiance in continuing to insist, oh, no, that sounds like a thing that Glory did. That sounds like a job for Dr. Professor Scientist. That's a typo. Fine. You're misreading it.
Yeah, I misread it again. But yeah, we're going to get more into Glory's uselessness, and it's just always a frustrating thing in the back of my mind. The last point I want to tuck on before we get to the iTunes recommendations and the ending is the incredibly fascistic way that power is structured in this story. We've always danced around, like, the very Randian way that a lot of characters are presented in this story. It's a lot of the big man of history cliche. I always make the mocking joke about Golden Blood being the secret perpetrator of all of the world's conspiracies, and he's the secret background horse that had a hoof in absolutely every action that was ever taken by the government and the military. But even then, even in the original story, the notion that, like, the ministries needed to have these six prominent members of society to be running them, and the massive character assassination that's required on behalf of a number of them to make them fit the Orwellian mold of the 1984 ministries. Like, the obvious one being Pinkie Pie, but, like, basically all of them are in one way assassinated, like, character-wise. Like, goddamn, like Applejack becomes fucking basically like a fucking mewling capitalist whose only business sense is, like, nepotism. Like, RBD just becomes, like, an out-and-out, like, pure, like, military grunt, like, murderer. Twilight Sparkle becomes fucking Joseph Mengele, essentially.
I mean, I think there's fair argument to be made that Twilight that Sparkle that's not too bad characterization.
Rarity is a goddamn necromancer.
Yeah, that is very stupid. I think the only two that I haven't fully disagreed with is, like, Twilight Sparkle becoming sort of a Mengele-esque figure. I can see, like, an adult Twilight going down that road. And I think outside of this podcast, I have talked about how much, like, no, actually, like, Applejack should be in the original show a much more interesting character, because she's a farm owner. She works in her family farm, like, her family business. I don't know if you've met too many farmers.
Yes.
They're rich and disconnected from human life beyond, like...
It's important to note that there are two kinds of farm industry. There's the industrialized farm industry that is mostly worked through migrant workers and is very hush-hush evil monsters. And then there are the personally owned land tycoons that Applejack fits into the second category a lot more.
Yeah, like petite bourgeois, like Like they're crazy, like, all of them.
Yeah.
Is it like some of them are nice enough to have like dinner with, but they're deeply disconnected from larger society and resent the hell out of larger society for that reason. So like being a nepotistic capitalist is entirely in the like base description of Applejack as a character. So that's fine.
Yeah. I suppose you're right about that. But yeah, and then in Project Horizons doubles down so much on this. It presents like the Orwellian nightmare is kind of almost being like romantic and sexy. Like we talk a lot about this a lot off cast, but in podcasts, I guess we haven't mentioned a lot. But like one of the biggest issues with the right is the right does not care about ethics or the ends that they've created through their means and the means they've created through their ends. They really only care about aesthetics. Like the Imperial Guard of Star Wars and Darth Vader himself are sexy because they all wear cool black armor. It doesn't matter that they're the bad guys. They're killing everyone. They're horrible space races. And Darth Vader is like a Lunchable crammed into a robot suit with a lightsaber.
Committing genocide on an entire planet. Destroying the ecosystem and population of an entire world just to make a point. Like just as a weapons test. A demonstration of power.
Yes. But the thing is that the right respects and jacks off to the power. Like, oh, it's impressive the Empire constructed the ability to destroy planets. Like, the human life is no longer matters in that context. And I guess the point to rear it back into the story is that, like, when you present the idea of fascism that is, like, entirely unchecked, that causes the end of the apocalypse, it doesn't matter that it's a bad thing because it's just so damn sexy the way it's presented. Like, FOE makes a lot of missteps with the way it handles the ministries, but it at least presents the idea that these character assassinated versions of the Pastel Horses have all gone down increasingly broken personal failures caused by the fascism that they created. Like all of them are atomized from each other. The concept of friendship is completely gone. There's a specific line they make of like, oh yeah, the friend, like, someone asks, like, well, why don't you just use the elements of harmony to solve the problem? It's like, oh, yeah, we can't. And that's just left unstated in Fallout Equestria because it's like, it's unstated because they're not friends anymore because they ruined the theme of the show. Like, that's a point of FOE. Like, they fucked up. Project Horizons, like, lifts their compliance with the apocalypse completely from them and burdens it entirely on this fictional character who is just a Randian Ubermensch who is suave and sophisticated and an aristocrat and you know has all the coolest gadgets and he invented all the cool technology. Like he's basically Rand Batman. Like it doesn't matter that he's a bad guy because he's so compelling about it, and that's where like that's the problem that a lot of the right like focuses on and why like it's not such a hot idea to make your villain so sexy.
I've said it before, but I'm convinced that communists and fash share one main characteristic in common, which is that they both see how broken the system is. Mm-hmm. But the solutions are the thing that differentiates them. Like commies want to like stop it. Want to save the world, where fash just want it to be cool. Like fash have resigned themselves to oblivion, but they just want to. They like if we're all going to like die, if we're all going to kill each other for no reason, it should at least look cool.
Yeah, well, it explains why like it explains the prominence of like zombie apocalypse losing a lot of their like anti-capitalistic like bite to them, and eventually becoming just like, man, isn't it gnarly to kill zombies? It's like, yeah, you're killing the unwashed masses because you finally get, like, legal authority to do so.
I've forgotten the name of it, and that's for the best because I don't want to recommend it to anybody. But there's apparently a By Troops for Troops comedy movie out there with, like, a bunch of UFC stars and stuff as guest actors that is basically, like, this is what fascists love about the idea of a zombie apocalypse. Like, the zero accountability. Like, the... You know the random like crazy crimes that PMCs do in Iraq and Afghanistan. The premise of this comedy is: what if a zombie apocalypse came to America, and we, the troops, could do everything that we get away with, like, could slaughter people like we did overseas here in the States.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Finally, the restraining bolt is off. I finally get to kill with impunity. It's a worrying thing, and like that's kind of a big problem with just dystopic future in general, is that it presents the idea that like fascism is bad, but it like doesn't do enough to actually sell that notion, because it also makes it, it also presents it as it works. Like it's like, you know, you got your Hunger Games, any of your battle royale kind of fiction, your fucking any zombie apocalypse, any post-apocalyptic wasteland setting. Almost all of them invariably like present the idea that like humans naturally sort themselves into a hierarchy based off of like ammunition or guns or capacity. So that means that the most skilled are the highest in power, like they should be, with air quotes. Because of course the only thing that's stopping us from a meritocracy is 90% of the population being exterminated. Not that the people in the positions of power want to facilitate that position of power. But it's just, it's a huge problem is they present that, like, there's always at least one major fascist faction who presents themselves as the only way that the future of the apocalypse can survive, and they're kind of right. Like, they're given at least a platform to talk from, and they're not just exterminated by, like, their own incompetence. Like, their presentation of the story alone sort of, like, validates their sense of ethics. But yeah, I guess that's most of what I wanted to say about fascism in the story we've sort of seen present so far in the story. It'll definitely become, there's definitely a lot more to go through, especially once we actually start getting to, like, when we get to the Enclave DLC in this story is when the stuff gets really ahead. But yeah, if there's anything else you want to say before we go do closing thoughts, Weird.
Tired. The Renaissance happened because the Black Plague wiped out a bunch of dead wood, allowing the Ubermensch among us, the Randian Supermen, to rise up. Wired, the Renaissance happened because Arabic scholars retreated in terror from Genghis Khan into the West, bringing with them Genghis, the number zero, and coffee.
And calculus.
Meanwhile, the massive labor shortage due to the apocalypse meant that the peasants had lots and lots of negotiating power with the aristocracy. How about that? So rate, comment, stars, thumbs up, subscribe, do whatever you can. If you like our product, please show it so that we can show up in the various internet metrics.
Maybe we can get on a Chapo some point.
I need your thoughts. I need your validation. I need it. I need to even if you want to shit on us, if you need to shit, if you did not like our product, please tell us so.
So that we can ignore your comments.
I'll meditate upon it. Fi will ignore you. I will give you my full consideration. I will give you Hegelian recognition. You are not a voice in the darkness.
So you want to play us out, Weird?
What's to play out? This was. I'm Sir Weirdington Esquire. He's Fi. And this was all a terrible mistake.